Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What mood were you in when you were painting this really happy painting? Were you happy? And it's like, probably not. But it's like, people, when paintings affect them, they automatically assume that you were feeling what they were feeling in that moment, which is interesting. And it's usually, you know, not that you're emanating that depression, but it's not really associated.
Welcome. I'm Doug Cassina. I'm an artist, a gallerist, a curator, and a collector. And this is Artbound, where we deconstruct the myths and misconceptions of the art world. We have the conversations here with artists that aren't going to be found anywhere else. In this episode, we're going to talk about color, and I have two artists whose bold use of it I'm really excited to share with you. First, we have Ana Valdez joining us from her studio in Oakland, California. Hi, Ana.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And from her studio in Toronto, Canada, is Jana Watson. Hi, Jana.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
And like I said, I'm really excited to have you two as guests on the podcast today because of your amazing use of color. I, first of all, want everybody here to start following them on Instagram so that they can see what I'm talking about. Before we dive into the topic, though, I want to introduce you to our guests. Ana Valdez received her MFA in painting from Boston University and has exhibited in museums and galleries all across the United States. She's been featured in Juxtapose magazine and New American Paintings. And most recently, she had a really fabulous exhibition at Crystal Bridges Museum. She's represented by Hashimoto Contemporary in San Francisco and New York and David B. Smith Gallery in Denver. Jana Watson is an artist based in Toronto. She has a degree in drawing and painting from the Ontario College of Art and Design, and she has extensively exhibited across Canada and internationally with over 30 solo exhibitions to date. She has her work included in major notable collections, including TD Bank, the Ritz-Carlton, Soho Metropolitan, Saks Fifth Avenue, and a dozen others. She has an upcoming show where she's also incorporating one of her other practices, which is rug making alongside her bold abstract paintings. Well, one of the things that really interested me that I think kind of during our pre-show interview that tied things together is you guys are both exploring materials outside of your kind of vernacular of painting. Jana, you were telling me about an upcoming show that you have that is incorporating your rug making practice into your painting practice. Could you kind of elaborate a little more on that?
Yeah, so I have a show coming up at my Toronto gallery, and it's called Fruit of the Loom. And so I've always had kind of a separate practice of making rugs, and I've made like painting rugs before, but this is the first time I'm actually exhibiting rugs and paintings in the same space. And my thought process for the show was really kind of guided by, working with rugs, there's so much misunderstandings, or I realized that like, in order to sell a rug, there needs to be a lot of education around the rug. And people, they don't understand the value of the rug and how much goes into it. Like, it's not just, you know, it's not just the whole concept and design of the artist, but it's the artisans. I have mine hand knotted in India, and it's like the skill and the amount of time and just like the cultural knowledge that goes into the actual act of making the rug. this show, I reference Bauhaus. So I have the main piece of the show. It's actually it was a little scary for me because I am an abstract painter, and I actually brought in an image of a snake with an apple, and the background of the rug is a Bauhaus pattern. So it was a nod to the Bauhaus, which was the first time that women were allowed to be involved in an art school. Consequently, they were only allowed to do things such as weaving and ceramics because those were more domesticated arts. So the concept of my show is to really like bring the rug back from the ground onto the wall and just start that conversation of the value, like why is craft valued differently than art, and kind of just coming back to the domesticity of weaving. And so, yeah, I'm really excited about just kind of incorporating the two of them together and questioning values of different crafts.
Well, and I'm really excited to kind of start off the podcast speaking to this because, A, I designed rugs for a lot of years. I think I had 8 lines of rugs that were handmade in Tibetan Nepal. And I just out that Anna has 2 tufting guns, and she's going to be doing some rug making for upcoming exhibitions too.
Love it.
And for me, the tie-in to color goes back to this idea of fabrics and patterns and traditional weaves. You know, sometimes you can tell where a person is from based on the color they're using in those textiles or in ceramics or in those type of objects that are regionally specific. And I think there's something there when we're talking about use of color that people start to automatically imply about the artist or about where in the world it's from based on color. Is that something that you kind of recognize, Anna, in the way that you use color and object in your practice?
100%. I went to school. I got my MFA at Boston University. And so the East Coast here in the States is very, very, I would say, it was just very regional in terms of the grayscale and the colors, and just like there was more of like a realistic, a lot of darks, the light is so different in Boston than it is in California. So people right away when they saw my paintings were like, oh, you must be from California or the West Coast or Florida or Latin America or something like right.
Where the sun's shining.
Exactly. Where there's light, where there's color every day, and you make those associations. So yeah, that's always been my experience. And even when people don't know me and they haven't even seen my name, they'll automatically think that my paintings are from California or Mexico or just somewhere south, right? Yeah. But I'm actually from Northern California. Born and raised.
Yeah.
But we get a lot of light here too. It's a beautiful, clear day outside right now, and the sun is shining brightly, and the spring is like wakening everything up, and all of the colors are coming out. And I'm a gardener as well. So just seeing relationships between colors here and there, outside, everywhere. You can just walk down the street and it's just bursting with color relationships. And that's really exciting to me. And that's just normal to me because of where I'm from.
Do you feel, Jana, that a place has a lot to do with the way that we interpret color? I guess what I was picking up on in Anna's conversation was, you know, there was the East Coast. There was even a difference between like Northern California and Southern California or Florida light. Or so does it feel like, so you're joining us from Toronto. Do you feel like there's regionally specific color palettes that people associate with where you're from?
That's a good question. I mean, Toronto is, we definitely have winters that are darker. And so we kind of have that kind of depressing light. That's a really good question, because I think it challenges some people's sensibility with color, because when you're in winter or in a pandemic or whatever, like I think my goal with my my shows this past year is like, I just want to go bright. I want to be happy. Like, I want to just like, I don't want to be depressed. Other people don't want to be depressed. I kind of want to like go outside of myself. So I don't know. I think sometimes like, I notice with other painters in Toronto and even with myself, it's like, it's a reflection outside of something that I want to like see that's not there necessarily.
Yeah. I think also if I could interject here, I was going to say that, I think it's part of something that we're not thinking of all the time. Just like with color, there's so many parts of it that we just do intuitively. And if you're seeing all of these colors around, they're like in the back of your mind. And so you may not go into a painting thinking, oh, I have to use all of these really bright colors because I'm from a place that has a lot of sun. You just, you're aware of it. And when you're in other places, I think like the lack of light, but I do remember when I was in Boston, the sunsets were amazing. And it was probably because it was the first pop of color I had seen for like the full day. So
I love sunsets. I think like someone asked me once if I was affected by nature, and then they're like, no, but your colors are too bright to be affected by nature because they didn't find my work to be that earthy. And I was like, no, it's the sky. Like you get so many different like fluorescent colors and it's like the sky's nature. It's like the most amazing part of nature, I think.
Well, I think it's interesting that we're kind of zeroing in on a couple of different things with color already, you know, kind of the regional specific ideas. And Jenna, you kind of mentioned emotional charge that comes with color as well, that you were trying to bring something bright and happy. So there's also this use of color, I guess, to reflect mood. And then also the reference to like the natural world. Where do you feel like your relationship with color has really kind of evolved from?
That is a very...
It's complex.
It's a complicated question. Thing. Yeah. So my grandfather was actually an abstract painter, and he was also a rug hooker. And that's where I got my interest and kind of my knowledge behind the scenes of rugs. And he never found a market for... He did hand hooking, which is crazy because I once tried to do like a square inch of rug hooking. And I was like, F this, this is crazy. So that's actually on a, where I found the rug tufting tool, because I was like, I want to make a rug, but I do not have the patience. So I found a rug tufting gun as well, cause it's kind of like an automated sewing machine, and it's so fun. But it just speeds up the process so much. But my grandfather, he was very unconventional with his color. He put the weirdest colors together that were so, you would want to say that it was ugly, but it was so interesting that it was beautiful. Like I can't really describe it, but he was just really, really out there with his color. And I was surrounded by these incredible hand hooked rugs that were just so, they weren't even funky. Like I want to say the word funky, but they were so, it was beyond, it was, you know, when you look at someone's sensibility and you know that there's knowledge, they know what they're doing. It's very particular. So it wasn't just random, like he didn't know what he was doing. It was just, yeah, so interesting. So I was surrounded by these crazy color fields of rugs. And so that definitely influenced my color sensibility, because I was kind of taught like anything goes. Like you do not match things. Like matching things is for basic people. Like, you know, it's like it's ugly doesn't really exist. It's like ugly can be super harmonious, and it's about the relationships of colors. And just like people, like all different kinds of people can have these relationships. And it's the weirder, the more interesting it gets. So I would say that was definitely a huge influence in the way that I see color and think about color.
Wouldn't you also say that a lot of people interpret color differently too? So if, I don't know, there's people that are colorblind, so the way they see color, or people that are hypersensitive in general, like myself, I think the way that color resonates with us is just very illuminated or just very vibrant on a daily. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I have to wear sunglasses a lot because I'm just very photosensitive.
Are you sensitive to like fluorescent lights?
Yeah. Which
either
is
one of you?
Yeah. I'll start sneezing right away.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yeah. I think that's actually a sign that you have like an extra, what's it called? Something in your eye.
Another cone or something.
Another cone is your sensitivity to fluorescent lights.
I can't leave the house without sunglasses on. Like it's like I noticed as soon as I walk in.
You're so cool. You got the espresso machine in every room of your house.
No, it's the gallery, and it's a tool to keep my staff on point, right?
I get it.
No, but it really is something. Like I absolutely am very sensitive to light as well. And I think maybe it is something that I've kind of just picked up too, because I'm protective of my eyes, because I, you know, that's what I do all day is I look at color, I look at composition. And for me, one thing that's, again, a very interesting thing that I want to dive in with both of you about is the juxtaposition of just your practices in general. Because Anna, you primarily do representational work. You know, you're working from life in some cases. Sometimes it's even doing a plein air painting. Whereas Jana, you're doing non-representational, non-objective work. How does that affect the way that you use color? Or I guess I want to put you guys in each other's position. Like, Jana, if you were doing representational work, would you still be doing the type of color choices that you are doing in your abstraction, and vice versa for you, Anna?
Well, I personally think like if you just have a certain color sense, you're going to use that no matter what it is that you're doing. Mm-hmm. Like I'm doing ceramics right now, and you know, I could go using traditional glazes, but it's so boring to me and I can't. So I have to like paint with under glazes and make them feel more as though they're a watercolor painting underneath or like a gouache painting, because I still need that extreme vibrancy.
And I would say that your work on your paintings, they don't necessarily match up to the natural world color wise.
No. They definitely don't.
I'm trying to give people a visual for their head. They're incredibly vibrant colors for the objects.
Think about – this is how I like to think about it, because it's also my favorite reference to – and my favorite film since I was a little girl is when you walk out into The Wizard of Oz and you see everything in Technicolor, right? Mm. So that's how I always want my reality to look, because I want you to describe – buildings as the Emerald City, or the shoes as being like a ruby slipper, or there's just the yellow brick road, for example, which these things are so basic in terms of how they're described, but I just feel like I want everything to I want to touch on every color, just because I think like that would be such a fun place to wake up to, is life in Technicolor, right? Because it's all oversaturated and glittery. And my use of glittery is like neon, actually. So it's – there's just something that sparkles in it without it actually sparkling. I get bored really easily. Not that I'm actually ever bored, but it's easy to bore me. So I think color is very exciting. And I am such a hedonist that I want to always be excited and feeling well in this way. So I think I just naturally gravitate towards those colors versus anything that – even my blacks are like purples. They're dark purples. They're never really black. It's really hard for me to use that color. So.
Can you relate to that? Do you have a hedonistic viewpoint on color?
I think a lot of painters do.
I think I would say I do. Yeah. I'm like, like, I guess from an abstract point of view, like when I started painting, I use a lot of block colors. So it'd be like pink here, red here, you know, kind of just exploring the relationships, kind of spaced out. And then I kind of like, the more confident I got with the material painting, I just started kind of like mixing them together a little bit. And there'd always be like certain combinations that I found in my own exploration that I was like, oh my God, I love that. Like it would be like some, I found that because I use mixed medium. So I found that there's like a Chinese red gouache that I like to mix with like a Payne's gray acrylic, and they erase each other when you mix them together. But then with like a titanium, bringing in a titanium white, they come back to life in a totally different way. So I found that there's little things that I found within my mixing explorations that brought out different relationships with colors that I really feel attracted to. So I tend to I bring them up here and there in my paintings. And that seems to be like something that repeats
itself. Yeah. I like that. I think I never really started to understand color until I started to mix my own paints, because everything had it was always intuitive. Mm-hmm. And then I think when I started to really understand why certain colors would react with others, it wasn't through a science book or just thinking about psychology. It was just, I'm going to make my own paint. So getting pigments and just seeing how certain, just like how you were talking about the Chinese red, which I'm assuming is like a vermilion or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And close to that.
Yeah. And then a gray, Payne's gray is my favorite blue to use, by the way. Mm-hmm. I put it into everything.
It's got some soul.
Yeah. It's like in every green that I use and it gets mixed into everything. But I wanted to learn how to make those colors on my own because I was just curious about it. So yeah, just making my own paint was the best way to learn that and to understand different pigments and how they react to others and how some of them, just when you throw them together, it's mud, and others it's just like, ooh, it's so elevated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Have you had a similar trajectory with your color story, Jana, where you started working with color in some way, and has it evolved and changed? Is there anything that you can point to, like using your own pigments, that's informed that?
What do you mean by
I feel like we all start at some place with color and our relationship to color, and it very much changes over time. And sometimes it's something very definitive that we can look to and say, oh my God, this was kind of a breakthrough in how I started seeing color. Have you had any of those kind of aha moments with the way that you use color that very much changed moving forward?
Yeah, I think there was a time where when I was just learning my material and even just learning what I was doing, because I would feel a little bit, I would get kind of insecure with the whole abstraction, especially at openings, because people would be like, but what does this mean? And what are you doing? And in the beginning, I was like, what? I don't know, because it is so intuitive. But the longer that I kind of worked with my materials and just kind of came into my own self as a painter and more confident as an artist, I realized that what I am doing is I'm playing with color and I'm playing with paint, and I almost feel like I'm an equal player to my material. So it's sure I'm manipulating some things, but I'm also, the way that I'm seeing things is I'm just letting everything kind of do what it wants to do and kind of have its own life and just let itself create itself. So I would say that my relationship to color has changed because I have found that they want to have the relationships that they want to have, and I kind of let them. And, so yeah, just say that I've become more confident in just mixing color and kind of just letting things be what they want to be.
And that tends to – that just happens over time.
It happens over time, yeah.
Yeah, of having a studio practice and just working and working. I remember when I first started painting, who knows what they're doing when they first start something, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to outline everything in black and it always felt like a drawing more so than a painting, where you start, color helps you build, right? You're not doing something that's color or a color book where you're filling in stuff because it's already outlined. But I think, like, for me, my painting really started to shift when I was like, okay, you could put this color next to another color, and it's building and creating that line versus you needing to have it encased in something.
It's structured, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that was like a fun evolution, and I think everybody kind of gets there at some point. If people were to do a study of how people start out painting and thinking about how to construct an image, it's very linear, right? Like, it's very, I guess we all kind of play with color books in the beginning. So, or that's how we're taught. But what if you weren't being taught that way? Right. How would it start?
Well, and both of you use a variety of mediums. I know, Anna, you do printmaking. There's also works on paper, the versus your ceramic practice versus your painting practice versus now incorporating rugs. For me personally, I've noticed that the medium tends to dictate the way that I approach using it. It's almost like this dance. I've noticed that if I try to force, you know, to paint with watercolor the way I'd paint with oil, it just, you know, it's, that's just a non-starter. Is that the same thing with color in relationship to those different mediums for you both?
No, I think like you're learning from each medium too, so you can take it to another one. So that's like why I'm working across the board, because one, I always want a new skill, and two, told you I get bored easily, so I want to play around. But I don't think the color would necessarily affect that at all, actually, because that's one thing you can bring from each medium is color. It's not dictated on the materiality, really. The color is pretty flexible, I feel.
Yeah, I also find that, like, with textiles, because you're working on a warp and weft, like, I almost appreciate the limitations of it, because then it's like, okay, well, I can work within these geometric shapes, and yeah, it's almost like when you don't have all of these options to mix and colors with a certain medium, it kind of just, those limitations almost help to create a composition.
You also just kind of accept them too and work within them. It's not like, okay, well, this is. And that's kind of the fun of creativity and learning and working in different mediums is like you accept your parameters and you work with them and try to make them interesting for yourself, even though you're like coming at it from one angle.
Yeah.
Are there colors that are like your fallback colors that you've noticed kind of show up everywhere? And also, is there a color, I think you were alluding that black is one of those colors that you might not really use anymore. Jana, is there a color that like you've just kind of said, okay, this doesn't work?
No, not really. I stay away from brown.
That seems like a good idea.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and I think it comes back to that when you're like mixing color and then you start getting the muddy color and you're like, okay, I don't know what's happening here. Yeah. Brown.
I do want to say I'm not opposed to using black at all. I just think like I would rather try to use something else there that could make it vibrate. And I think like
bring some light into it.
Exactly. Like white with black is really nice because it's a high contrast and that will really vibrate. So I try to find an equal to whatever other color I'm using. So I use yellow a lot. So I'm thinking like if I used black there, it's kind of like, okay, that's very obvious. But if you used a deep Egyptian violet or something that's so dark and purple, but there's still that vibrancy, especially in different kinds of light, it just adds more. So I think like –
Do you find that you have a goal to create those vibrations between colors? Like, is that a goal?
I don't think it's a goal. It's just, it doesn't feel right when I'm working on the painting. I'm like, what is this missing? It just feels, it's not working until you get that quite right. So I think that's also with composition for me. It's not just about color, but if the color is off in my painting, then the painting isn't done. Right. And nobody knows what that means except for me, because that's my reality. I'm creating those spaces. I'm painting from life, but I'm also creating its own new technicolor reality.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that was a really good thing to highlight, was the fact that color can be as much of a compositional element as anything else in the painting. And I think if you're just starting off playing with those ideas, that might not be something that you pay attention to as much. I guess depending on, you know, if you're painting representationally or non-objective too. As a non-objective painter myself, I am constantly looking at how my eye leads through a color story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you get too... For me personally, if you get too caught up in how something should be and too technical about it, it's going to feel contrived. So I think with anything, you work on things and you introduce those concepts into your practice, but you do it pretty gradually. And then at some point, it just kind of takes over. Like, I used to give myself assignments where I would be... color to me has never been something that I ever thought about, because it's just so natural to me. Mm-hmm. So I never thought to give myself any assignments on that. But like with composition, for example, I'd be like, okay, make certain paintings that have a circular storytelling pattern, or I don't even know how to explain that, but like, just, I want things to have a circular path in the painting. Now I want this one to have a triangle path. So I would give myself assignments, and now I just don't think about it. It just happens. And I like that. But I think if you go into something having too much of a structure or an idea of like, I have to use this amount of color in this way, it's going to feel forced.
Mm-hmm. Did you both take very formal color theory?
No,
I did. And it was so bad. I was very bad at it.
You know, there's some things from color theory that have always, you know, kind of stayed with me, that are kind of like some hierarchy of color type of ideas, and like what your eye sees first as far as colors, and how that's like been incorporated into the way we live in the world. For example, red is the first thing that your eye will point out. So I know a lot of like landscape artists, you know, will put at like the one-third mark, like a little red barn or something, you know, that like draws your eye right to that. But that's why stop signs are red, is because that's the first color you're going to pull out of your environment. It's also why animals have that are poisonous have red markings, is the, for the same reason.
That's an evolutionary thing. I actually just listened to or watched The Life in Color with David Attenberry.
Me too.
Yeah. And I was just like, okay, there's finally one of them out there that's not talking about how the world is going to die in 10 years and everything's going to go extinct. So I really enjoyed it. Also just talking about the language of color and how different species and evolution has really programmed our bodies and animals to communicate through color, and our natural selection as well. Mm-hmm. So they were talking about how humans and some primates actually have this really wide spectrum of color vision, but we can't really see in the ultraviolet, which is a lot where the insects have their vision. So they were talking about bees and, oh my God, I think that's, I watched really it cool. twice. It was really exciting.
Yeah, you know, I just recently watched that too. And he does have one that's a documentary that came out that's like a witness statement for how the world is going to end in 10 years. So he does have that. Like, you can watch that one next. He also has some solutions, so it's great. but
it's just so depressing and actually terrifying. So I have to, I mean, I don't want to be an ostrich and bury my head in the sand, but... You know,
well, you know, there's, I heard this recently, because part of, I think, something that keeps coming up for me is this idea of mindful looking. and, you know, noticing what's coming up when we're observing things. And I think color is a really interesting place for that because it is such a visceral reaction that we have to color. You know, some colors, you know, turn us off. Some colors very much draw our attention to it. But, you know, for me, it's this idea of, okay, so all of these colors, all of these things have such nuance that we don't even know why we're drawn to it sometimes. Are there colors that you just, when you lay down, you just have these visceral reactions to?
I mean, I feel like we all, we're very excited by color, right? Like, I dream in different color realities too. So I'll have, yeah, like when I'll dream there. And I don't know if that's just because I watch a lot of films and I really enjoy a good, I don't even know how to explain that, but like a film that goes into a different color reality. Well, I was talking about The Wizard of Oz, so something very similar to that. I'll have dreams in sepia tone, or I'll have dreams that are in, where things are very highlighted in color that you're supposed to think about, or they have, it almost feels like a video game sometimes. And I don't play video games, so I don't.
Oh, it's so cool.
Yeah. It's, I'll wake up and I'll just be like, all right, that was interesting. What does that mean?
Yeah. But when I was a kid, I have not talked about this in a really long time, but I used to see little colors, like little polka dot colors that were like in primary colors, like purple, blue. I mean, purple's not a primary, but blue, red, and yellow. And they would just fly around my head and I would try to catch them.
Wait, I did that too.
Really?
Yes. I would see colors coming in through my window. I mean, I was clearly tripping. Around. Yeah. I obviously was like having some psychedelic shit going on there, but.
But you're
like,
a child, so.
Yeah. But you accept it. So
yeah, you're like, oh, and I would just like, I would catch them sometimes and put them in my pocket and like not tell anyone.
Oh, wow. I never felt like I could touch them, but I could see them happening and just coming in through the window.
I could see them whenever I wanted to.
Wow. That's
used to see them around people, you know, where I kind of, and I think we're kind of train ourselves out of that magic of seeing over our lifetimes too as we grow,
like auras,
you know. I think it was just more like energy. I don't know how to explain it, but it was something that I remember seeing very clearly when I was young.
Do you still see that?
You know, I the last time that I really remember doing that was, God, I remember in college at a really interesting seminar where I could just like, it was the, it was so engaging, and it was like a big 200 room, you know, lecture hall, and it was palpable, the energy that was there, and I could absolutely like see it. But that was one of the last times that I really remember identifying it. I think it's something that you train yourself away from seeing.
Well, there's definitely people that train themselves to see it, and as they get older. So I know that humans have that ability to see chakras and different auras in people and in nature and even objects. And I do think that is like an energy that's coming off of something.
Yeah. And I guess, that's why like color excites us so much, because there is that spiritual element to it of light and just that vibration that gives, that it gives off.
Yeah. And it's maybe people don't even, they can't see it, but they're like feeling it with color.
Yeah. I remember once, and I'm sober now. I'm not actually an advocate for drugs, but I got really high. And it was the first time that I was like, oh my God, I was staring at this blue jacket that I had. And I was like, you had to be in the moment. But I was like, you know, you can touch the jacket, but you can't touch the blue jacket. Mm. And so it was like, the blue, the color blue is just like, it's separate from the object, right? And I remember just being like, blowing my own mind in that moment. But yeah, it's really cool how, like, you know, the life that we live in, this reality that we live in, is constantly changing because of color and because of light. And like those moods that are shifting, like you wake up on a rainy day that's a little bit gloomy and it affects your mood, and it's the light and it's the color, right? And it's so, the psychology of that is, it's incredible.
Yeah, I'm useless on a rainy day. I really am, which is really annoying, and I'll get really depressed. But then the next day when it's sunny, I'm like pumped and I'm ready to get into the studio and I'm painting, and I'm like, woo, woo, where did all this energy come from? I don't know. It's the sun. I guess I really like vitamin D. I don't know. But yeah, that's exciting.
Do you both then feel like you're trying to project mood and story through your color for other people? Is it like, are you like putting a happiness that you're like, okay, I want people to radiate this color and this mood? Is that a conscious part of your painting practice?
No, I don't do anything for anybody else. It's all for me. So, I mean, I'm chronically depressed. So it's a very much like my painting practice really helps me in managing that depression. People, they look at me and they look at my work and they're like, you must be a really happy person. Like,
I've done that too.
Yeah, right? I'm like,
Or like, really? What mood were you in when you were painting this really happy painting? Were you happy? And it's like, probably not. Not that there's like, you know, it's like, you know, people pick when paintings affect them, they automatically assume that you were feeling what they were feeling in that moment, which is interesting. And it's usually, you know, not that, you know, you're emanating that depression, but it's not really associated.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And also, I really can't paint when I'm going through a period of extreme depression. Mm-hmm. I can't even be in the studio. I wallow under the covers and just, you know, it's just not, I need to be in a good headspace to work. So maybe that's why it's coming out, because there's like pure intention and sounds so cheesy, but like love when I'm working. And I think that does come through. Mm-hmm. A lot, because I love what I'm painting and I love what I'm doing and I get really excited by that, but I have to be in a good headspace to do it. So you can imagine how this last year has been when trying to work. It's definitely feel a little behind.
Well, and I think that's why we're all, you know, makers, is because there is this love. It's a way of showing up in the world. And there's an adage that about, you know, kind of that idea, and I think you both touched on this, about, you know, maybe some of these more beautiful, lighter images come about when you're in a darker place. It's because maybe you're wanting to project that into your personal world.
I think you can like tune into it more because you're craving it. It's a necessity to,
you're like,
it's part of like your self, for me, it's like part of my self-care and
I definitely agree.
Like creating your own reality and making a safe space for you, for yourself.
Yeah, I kind of did that with my – I had a show a few months ago, and it was called Finding Joy. It was actually based on my niece, whose name is Joy. She's like crazy 2-year-old, 3-year-old, and she –
there is the best video on the internet right now of her on a rocking horse. Oh my God.
That's where the show started. She's wearing this dress that I gave her. And she's just on this rocking horse and she has this curly hair and she's just giving it. She's so hilarious.
It's perfect.
But I ended up deconstructing her on that rocking horse in a painting. And I was actually going through a really difficult time in that moment. And I was literally trying to find joy. And I was like, I'm trying to find this thing that I'm making right now. It's not necessarily coming out of me from this joyful place. I'm like in search of this lightness and this freedom. And I think that's really like what our job is as artists, is like we are in this state of constantly becoming and constantly striving for like the next thing that we're doing, creating life.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to approach it. I don't think everybody does. I feel like that's probably how a lot of artists think about things for sure. What kind of makes us really special in that way.
Well, I think we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we're going to kind of figure out some more ways to incorporate, you know, bold color into your practices.
Highlighters.
Highlighters. Sparkle magic.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
I'm really interested in going into some other realms of psychology and assumptions that people make with color. How have you had the discussion of color and gender come up with your work in the past?
Well, for me, I just think that if you look at my paintings, you would automatically be able to tell that there's a female identified person probably making that painting, not just because it's super colorful, but the objects that are in it as well, and the reference to a lot of textiles. And I'm not saying that other men don't make paintings that have a lot of color, but I think if you look through art history, you can kind of tell there's a breaking point, or like there's a shift that starts happening pretty recently, I would almost say, where color, and I think this is when women started becoming more accepted in the art world, it gets kind of used more generally and broadly. Because I think for the most part within Western art history and just Western ideas of art, it's very male dominated and therefore very limited in color use, because one, I think just naturally men don't see color a certain way, but also color is very much associated with the feminine and queerness and the other, and also primitive. So it's just has kind of been rejected for the longest time, I think, by the white male dominance of the art world. I guess I have a lot to say about that, but.
Well, let's dive into it. Is that something, Jana, that you've had assumptions about gender based on color?
It is interesting because I don't have a subject matter. I just basically have color. I would assume that most people assume that I am a female identified person behind that's creating the work. But I did once, I met a client and they, for some reason, were very surprised that I was a woman because they thought I painted like a man, and I didn't have the chance to ask them what that meant. But I found that really interesting. I think it might've, at the time I was putting a little bit more of an architectural, like I was using more architectural lines in my work. And so I think that kind of left brain kind of structured linear thing kind of probably contributed to that assumption. I've never really been questioned on that. So I would assume that people just assume that I'm, you know, female identified.
And I mean, like, it's interesting how you invited two women to be on this podcast versus two men, right? Because if you look overall at how much, I would say what is dominating very colorful paintings, it would be probably a lot of women, right?
Women
painters.
And for me, I'm just thinking of like my roster of artists that I have at the gallery.
I mean, look at Daisy.
I mean, Daisy, yeah. and you know,
hey, Daisy.
that was a shout out to Daisy Batten. But you know, on my roster of artists at the gallery, you know, I think I have maybe two white straight males, you know, and I don't know. You know, this is an interesting conversation for me because I don't know that it's like in the forefront of how I look at art. But I know, like, when I'm thinking about color, I also, it's part of just my entire aesthetics. Part of my decision making is, you know, does this artist match one of my shirts? you know, and can I, I'm very much joking with that. I've had artists who have asked me to like match my clothes to their paintings at openings. And
I
stuff
wish too. Everyone could see Anya's face right now.
But I think it's like this entire aesthetic that like emanates through the way that I look at things. And I think color is such an amazing part of that. And I don't know where that comes from in myself or what those, you know, what those choices are or why I'm drawn to certain colors.
Yeah. So Doug, I have a question to you as a curator then. So do you feel that you, you know, when you're choosing artists that you want to represent, is it, are you conscious of the fact of their gender, or is it just like pure aesthetic? Like you're looking for that kind of the color that speaks to you, or what are you looking for?
You know, I think at some point or another, there's a conversation around that. I don't know that that's the even in the top several considerations. You know, first, yeah, it's obviously something that I'm just attracted to, that there's some kind mm-hmm. of curiosity for me around. Yeah. And then it goes from there.
Yeah.
Well, I first want to say that I feel like it's pretty rare to have a 98% on your roster of being female.
Oh, well, it's not just female. I'm just saying white, okay. White straight males.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
I don't know what the exact breakdown is, but I'm proud that it's a very diverse group that I represent.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think you're extremely progressive.
Okay, so we totally went off subject here. So let us circle back towards. Should we talk more about my clothes?
No.
Yeah, so I guess, like, could you define for me, like, what you're noticing as, like, a distinctly gender-specific use of color?
Well, I think just like there's even going towards like how more men tend to go more towards design and architecture, mm-hmm. right? And so basically, I think there is that structure and lack of color. And then there's just a lot of association with lack of color with Western white male thinking. And I think it also kind of, if you really want to break it down, goes towards religion too, like Christianity a little bit, and how whiteness is very much considered like purity. And like when you think of heaven, what do you think of? The white space, a pearly gates, like that's what we're taught, right? I mean, I'm not Catholic or Christian, but I know the lore, and it's it's very and how hell is a color that is red and dark. So there's very much these color realities of these spaces. And when you think of something other, it is color. Otherness is color. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really interesting, and in how that kind of is in our mindsets and our subconscious too, of just like the stories that we're brought up in. And so I also think that could be a little bit, I'm kind of not being able to really clarify what I'm trying to say, but.
Well, and I think I understand where you're coming from on that, because it all is really incredibly nuanced, because there's symbolism that we relate to certain colors.
Exactly.
There's ideas of cultural heritage that we relate to certain colors, to certain patterns, to the way things show up that are kind of just ingrained in the way that we see the world that maybe we haven't really defined for ourselves. And I think that goes back to this idea of mindful viewing, you know, and kind of understanding, okay, why am I curious about this color? Why is it bringing up these emotions or these assumptions or these whatever it might be bringing up, and identifying that in our own histories.
Yeah. Who's, is it Gatie? Is that who it is? Like the theories of color way back in the 1800s, there's just like this document of color theory and how it was very specific to symbolism and some psychology and just the time So I'm really hoping I'm saying that right. But yeah, it's a really interesting document.
Well, and I think we're taught, even as artists, different ideas of color relation. I know that there have been, kind of studies on like what colors sell, you know, ideas around blue. That too.
Blue.
Well, there's the old adage, if you can't make it good, make it big. If you can't make it big, make it red.
I make everything red. Big and red, and I think it's good, okay?
I totally agree. I'm just telling you, like, these. This is what we're doing. We're busting these.
Yourself.
We're busting these myths, you know? This is all these, like, things that we've been taught, you know.
This is not myth busters here. Or is it?
Like, I want to say some auctioneer had even done this study of, like, what colors were selling the best on secondary market and what subject matters. And I want to say like it went white, red, blue, yellow, green, black.
But who was buying them?
I have no people.
People with lots of money.
Or people who buy art.
People with lots of money.
Lots of money.
So, by the way, both of you guys sell art for lots of money.
I wish it could be more. Yeah. Well, I guess my question when I say like who's buying it, I kind of feel like that study is very specific because it's not really.
Yeah. Because there's certain color, superstitious colors in certain cultures that they just don't. Mm-hmm. Like, I think actually, is it Asian culture, like red, they're like, do not want to buy red paintings. I thought it was lucky. Maybe it was purple's lucky, but you don't. Anyways, I might not be getting this right, so don't repeat me.
No, but okay. So I want to go back to just saying like how if that study was done of like who's buying more paintings with a specific color and what else did you say about it?
Then there's also subject matter too. Like they were talking about like if a landscape. Cow is present or if it's a dog or what kind of dog.
Oh.
Yeah. There's all kinds of – like I mean you can – check data to make whatever thing up you want, yeah. Right?
I feel like a better study would be now not about what sells because I don't think what sells is representational of like the universal of people's experience towards images. I mean, we have all the data right here in our computers, like what images get circulated the most, how do trends happen? That would be a more, I feel, accurate representation of that because I feel like there's just a specific group of people that are able to buy art at that level. Were you saying Christie's? Yeah, that's a very specific group of people. And I don't feel like it represents every, like the broader spectrum.
Speaking of like colors that come out, are you guys people who like pay attention to the Pantone color of the year and those type of things?
No.
Oh, thank God.
We're not designers.
Oh, I've had artists reach out to me. They're like, you know, this color purple is the Pantone color of the year.
Yeah. Well, maybe they got a notification or something.
I heard purple's in.
Purple is so hot, guys.
It's so in.
So hot.
You both had mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that use of color really is this evolutionary journey that you just got to spend time with. Are there other advice that you might give somebody who's struggling to kind of find color that tells their story? You know, maybe how to look at it differently or how to approach finding their own color story.
I just feel like if people were being really authentic about their color story, I guess I don't really understand what a color story is, but just maybe the reality of how they're perceiving and interpreting and then illustrating color. it's just seeing it and doing it as you feel it. I don't think.
Well, or is there a way of looking, I think, like that has helped you?
A curator gave me this advice, and it actually, I think it really helped me in my life. And she was looking at my earlier work, and she was giving me a critique, and she was like, you know, it's good, but you need to learn how to mix. And I was like, well, how do I learn how to mix? And as we know now, it takes time and experience. You don't just like be like, okay, well, now I'm going to start mixing color and that's it. So I asked her, like, how do I do that? And she said, just go look at as much art as you can. Like, go to every art gallery, go to New York, go to Montreal, go, you know, and just look at other people's work and then try to create that. And so that's what I did. Like, I would go and I would look and I would try to be like, I wonder how that person did that. And then I would bring it back to my studio. And this is like, I wasn't creating a body of work. I was just experimenting and just building up my own repertoire. And it wasn't that I was trying to copy them, but it was like, I was trying to dissect what I saw. And then my own voice would kind of come out of that kind of exploration. So I found that just really looking at other people's work and trying to interpret that. And then, you know, finding your own voice in that.
For me, it's like looking at work and seeing what excites me and then just trying to emulate that and echo it in my own paintings, like picking and pulling, because that's already your language, right? Things that are exciting you, and you're just picking and pulling that apart. And I always think, like, if people want to paint in colors that are not mixed, go for it, whatever. Like, nobody should... I just think like there's so much play with color and it's fun. So you do what feels right. And I think if you start trying to do things in a very forced way, it's going to look very forced. And with anything, and I think Jana was saying this too, it's just making the work and you get there. Like anything, you have to practice. You have to put the work in and you have to experiment and all of that stuff comes. Time, like nobody wakes up and is like a painter that's amazing or something. You have to get from point. Well, it's a journey, right? There's a path.
It's just doing it. It's doing the work.
Yeah. And I feel like there's almost, it's never like, oh, I now feel like I'm there. I'm a great painter. I think it's more like you're at a point where you're like, oh, I really like what I did. And I feel comfortable making that work. And I feel confident. Maybe comfortable is not the right word, but like a confidence in it and just accepting what it is that you've made and putting it out there. And if people, you know, say something about it, you're like, well, whatever, that's your thoughts.
I think there's been a theme this whole season about following your authentic curiosity. So thank you again for echoing that today. You guys have been fantastic guests. I'm so excited to have had you on the podcast today.
Wait, we're done?
Oh my gosh. Well, we could do another hour. We'll do another episode.
But I have so much more to say.
Thank you everyone for listening to the Artbound podcast. For more information about the guests and what we've discussed, go to artistnetwork.com/artbound. You can also find ways to connect with me and the Artbound team. We'd love to hear from you. If you've enjoyed the show, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen. Artbound is an Artist Network podcast and produced by Golden Peak Media. It's hosted by me, Doug Cassina. Our producer is Daisha Clay, with audio engineering by Evan Rutherford. Director of podcasts is Jared Mayer. Executive producer for Artist Network is Scott Meyer. Trisha Waddell is the director of content. Sarah Van Patter handles all our marketing. And Vanessa Childers does all things digital. If you'd like more information on sponsoring or advertising on Artbound, go to goldenpeakmedia.com. I'm Doug Cassina. Until next time.